The lecture is called A Brief History of Cultural Genitals. A prologue. On the occasion of the Documenta 12, the curator Roger M. Bürgel posed three leitmotifs, the second being the Agambian question, what is bare life? And he gave it a peculiar and daring Bataillon turn by saying, but as in sexuality, absolute exposure is intricately connected with infinite pleasure. Still, it remains to be clarified what is being exposed if life is being bared, let alone the thesis that infinite pleasure would be the outcome. Already in June 2006, an illustrious group of international artists, theorists, and curators took the occasion of the leitmotif text to discuss a whole array of topics around bare life on the Australian website Empire Soft Skin Space. You can, I think, still find it there. There, in the middle of a lot of status fighting around the dangerous claim of the artist being the natural-born embodiment of bare life, in his usually exposed and precarious condition, Michelle White, assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Tulane University, intervened with the following statement. Now I quote her. Science studies scholars indicate how the biological and fleshy aspects of sex are also constructed and medically produced. This makes a distinction between gender and sex messy and perhaps counterproductive. People rarely see the genitals of other individuals that they have accepted as biological men or women. They are also rarely considered the possibility that there is an array of genital variations. And that's where the strange new term, cultural genital, comes in. First chapter, Anatomie ist Schicksal. That's a German quote, and the English translation would be Anatomy is Destiny. A quote now. At this point, our material, for some incomprehensible reason, became far more obscure and full of gaps. The female sex, too, develops an Oedipus complex, a superego, and a latency period. May we also attribute a phallic organization and a castration complex to it? The answer is in the affirmative. But these things cannot be the same as they are in boys. Here, the feminist demand for equal rights for the sexes does not take us far, for the morphological distinction is bound to find expression in differences of psychical development. Anatomy is destiny, to vary a saying of Napoleon's. The little girl's clitoris behaves just like a penis to begin with, but when she makes a comparison with a playfellow of the other sex, she perceives that she has come off badly, and she feels this as a wrong done to her and as a ground for inferiority. For a while still, she consoles herself with the expectation that later on, when she grows older, she will acquire just as big an appendage as the boys. Now you can guess who might have written this. Any guesses? Freud. Yes. Der Untergang des Oedipus-Komplexes. So, Freud's basic thoughts about the unchangeable inferiority of the female physique are well known and well studied. Freud might have thought that these assumptions were necessary conclusions from his analytical insights, yet we know very well today that they were in fact commonly held convictions of the European bourgeoisie of the 19th century that much rather preceded and informed the coming into being of psychoanalysis than followed from it. Accordingly, the very abstract and symbolic order of the sexes that marks male as a plus and female as a minus, a pure lack of being, is a highly modern and historically particular way of organizing the sexes. As a quite humorous quote by Denis Diderot in D'Alembert's Dream, himself a representative of what Foucault has coined the classical tableau, is evidence to there have been other ways earlier to define sexual difference without Freud's massive bias. So Diderot states that woman has all the body parts that man has, the only difference being that in one case a bag hangs out in the open, whereas in the other case it is being inversed to the inside. Which is, now we don't see it because we see something very different now. It's actually also one of the Austin Powers films. He's now winning over some highly sexualized fembots, female robots, by showing his own sort of artificial secondary asset, which is a toupee of chest hair. But what I was about to say is, funnily enough, the logo of this conference, Ars Electronica, is displaying Diderot's structure of the sexes, which where one of these graphic like triangles goes down and the other goes up. These two figures, these two little robot figures on the logo. It is now not my agenda to propose a return of the somewhat grotesque but good-natured morphology of the sexes, even though a later analysis of morphing bodies, limbs, and genitals might again lead us there, but to claim that Freud's bias, as unbearable as it may seem, serves as the narrow passage of modernity through which everyone has to pass in a historical primal scene, so to speak, to enter our contemporary stage of an open morphology of sex. The determinist claim to an Oedipus complex that revolves around a boy's fear to lose one's sexual organ and a girl's grudge to lack an equivalent one from the start might be a matter of biology and individual psychology in Freud's view, yet to us this dispositive is a historical-cultural formation that in Lacan's reading, or rather our reading of his reading, accomplishes the formation of sex as a shifting signifier. Freud invests the male organ with the privileged and essential function of the sexual signifier, and even Lacan sticks to an equation of phallus and penis that he might himself already understand as contingent, but still likes to uphold as the one contingency that cannot be altered, as something like the one stable joint around which the whole ever-changing symbolic order revolves. Still, the phallus is a lack, according to Lacan, and being such, it opens up the gap of desire that makes sexual attraction possible. Caught in between the simple essentialist notion of sexual difference, being a fact of nature that comprises anatomy, endocrinology, social and psychological factors in a normative package, and the unspecified claim to sex and gender being constructed and therefore changeable by one's individual free choice and likes, a third way would be to demarcate the complex terrain of sexuality in relation to a regime of the body that is always already marked by the symbolic order as a matter of direction. If there is a sexual signifier that is both defined as a lack and as a shifter, as the lack in the other that desire both discovers and wants to cover up, there is always direction. Whatever morphing, innovation in size, function and form, the new wonderland of biotechnology and media might hold in store for the good old sex organs, it will still be a matter of a certain directedness of desire that, as amorphous and indefinable as it may be by definition, cannot be altered in all direction at all times and under all conditions. To bear this in mind means to address the vicissitudes of the market that always lurks behind the playground of new erotic scenes and techniques. This market makes a claim to infinite manipulation by reducing the complex landscape of shapes, actions, and desires to a matter of visible and repeatable assets. Being critical about this market does not demand a simple return to the conservative ideas of sex, but to hold on to desire as the elastic but essential bond that needs to vibrate to give objects, bodies, and functions a sexual meaning. There is a strange ambivalent ring to Freud's famous wisdom that anatomy is destiny, a phrase that betrays Freud's affinity to antique tragedy and pathos. This phrase, seemingly pointing at the fact of life that has been imposed upon us by a higher power, determining all our wishes and actions, also connotates a certain artificiality of the very same fate. The inner logics of the Greek tragedy of fate imply that as soon as someone realizes the vicissitudes of destiny, his rather semiotic reading is opening up a game between the humans and the gods. Destiny is being understood as a ball being played from the other side, challenging the mortals to respond. Accordingly, the unchangeable mold of anatomy could be read as a set of assets, as a set of pieces, as it were, as in chess, that every player can use strategically. This tampering with destiny in the very utterance of confirming it is further supported by Freud's phantasmatic identification with a disappointed little girl who, quote, consoles herself with the expectation that later on, when she grows older, she will acquire just as big an appendage as the boys. In the eyes of this little girl that Freud impersonates there, the anatomical fate of her very inferiority is being embodied by an appendage, a supplement signifying both artificiality and detachability. The thing making all the undeniable difference of anatomy is nothing but a screwed-on device, as if this girl would gaze at the boy's organ through the eyes of the already blooming castration complex, according to which the boy fears the loss of this most appreciated body part, as if it were only loosely tied to his body, a perspective that the girl, according to Freud, is actually lacking, as she has nothing to lose from the start. Freud's complex setup of envy seems to render the girl's gaze the very sight of implanting a castration complex that she does not know herself. And only by this complex set of relations, represented by the play of gazes as partial objects, the sexual organ is suddenly transformed into a detachable part, an overdetermined signifier being both a fetish and a toy endangered by loss. One could therefore finally speak of something like the politics of sex making its appearance in the guise of a crude biologist claim. The very artificiality of this anatomical destiny is made even more obvious by the fact that Freud wants to tell the facts of life by quoting and secretly distorting a quote that in itself already displays the whole manipulative rhetoric of a so-called historical quote, this quote. That anatomy is destiny. Quote again Freud, anatomy is destiny to vary a saying of Napoleon's. Freud, who cannot help to toy around with his supposed reader's bourgeois education, can, other than some members of the internet community today, who simply had the nerve to claim that Napoleon, being a French speaker, had in fact said l'anatomie, c'est le destin. You can find it on their website. Someone is proud to find out what Napoleon really had said, the same thing in French. Freud could count on his readers being able to weigh the very particular replacement he has in fact manufactured in Napoleon's original quote, which is not l'anatomie, c'est le destin. Freud and Napoleon were both still children of the pompous pathos of historical grandeur that makes a phrase into a destiny and destiny into a phrase. So they both agreed on destiny. Yet, what lurks behind the anatomy that Freud introduces in a somewhat ironical gesture? Only the mold of a quote by Napoleon could provide Freud with the license to blow up the humble domestic facts of anatomy to such historical dimensions as if, for a fleeting moment, it could have been the genital and not the face to be celebrated in the Hollywood close-up that will possess the visual desire of the century to come. Well, Napoleon supposedly had said, geography is destiny. I will for a moment leave all possible implications of digging out the geopolitical base from underneath Freud's anatomy and thus linking the seemingly domestic sphere of individual psychology and in fact the private parts to the vast realm of strategic geopolitics to your imagination. So it's a bit of a lengthy paper, so there is this whole part about sex and gender theory that I might sum up in a rather spoken version. So the thing is that there has been a very important book, as it seems. I was also not informed about it before I started this research. As early as 78, authors' names I should still find out, Susan J. Kessler and Wendy McKenna, wrote this book, Gender, an Ethno-Methodological Approach, where they investigate on the subject of transsexuality. And this very specific subject gave a reason to sort of rework the whole difference of the category of sex and gender, because what they were finding out, and it's already a well-known fact today, is that the gender role, the gender identity to a transsexual subject is a fixed one, whereas the sexual and anatomical morphology of the body has to be changed according to gender. So in this sense, the theory goes, gender is a fixed category and sex has to go with gender. Therefore, all the anatomical changes that have to be applied with surgery, but before between the psychological wish to be the other gender and the other sex, and this surgical and usually very difficult and very expensive sex change, there is also the hormone treatment. And it's an interesting point if we still think that it's so easy to think about sexual morphology as clearly being marked with a difference, whereas gender behavior can vary in many ways. Of course, hormones can render a person, as I know from my own friend, one of my own friends, hormones can really render someone to a very large degree into the other sex and gender without a surgical altering. So there's an interesting point, because hormones are already biologically effective. They're not just symbolic or psychological or social, but still you can still keep the already altered genitals of your earlier but not accepted sex. So in a way you turn into a artificially but in fact medically triggered hermaphrodite. And there is the other position, and this makes the whole story quite complicated, that's why I don't read the whole paper, that on the other hand there is something that we could call the paradigm of classical feminism that more or less is only interested in the changing of gender roles as social and psychological and symbolic setups, but on the other hand accepts sex as a propriety of the body and as a sexual difference of genitalia as something that is sort of given, that is sort of unchanged, but is of a certain unimportance. There I quote a very interesting paper by Asia Friedman. Generally speaking, the self-evidence of sex difference is then tempered by minimalizing its significance, arguing that while sex differences do exist, they are unimportant. Well, this is more or less a summing up of maybe the 70s or still 80s positions of a classical feminist paradigm, but of course there have been lots of changes to this. This assumption of classical feminism has of course been challenged by race and queer studies for a while already. Still, the probably most powerful objection to this formula of variable gender and sort of a basic physical sex came from Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto as a powerful allegory uniting the open historical horizon of biotechnology and the wake of a symbolic culture of metro and poly sexualities toying around with sexual persona beyond the hetero queer demarcation line. And she's actually speaking of a structure of a denial concerning the very artificiality or the whole subject of sexual difference in this feminist paradigm. And this denial takes on the structure of saying, yes, I lack this thing, but it will grow later. And this is again the denial actually of Freud's little girl. Yes, I lack this thing, but it's ugly and stupid anyway, typical tropes of denial. As quoted in the beginning of this section, sexual difference is, according to Friedman, a pink elephant that is subject to a double denial, as we also have to deny the fact that we are denying it. Well, might be Puritanism, but this is not really such an important point here. Dealing with this structure, we are approaching one of several sides of a complex and overdetermined metonymical structure between body and body part, core and surface, identity and behavior, and indeed culture and biology, that will eventually lead to the introduction of the long-awaited term cultural genital. It seems as if all gender trouble used to stop at the zip, as if gender is something to be modified, analyzed, and addressed while dressed. In this sense, gender is a surface phenomenon dealing with issues of social and power relations, behavior, appearance, hierarchy, communication, etc. In this sense, gender is conceived as being superimposed or projected on a physical substance. This substance stays hidden and private, exactly like a private part, the cursed part that is both subject of desire and denial. by excluding the genitals from gender agenda, by keeping them locked in the darkness of dirty domestic secrecy, the classical paradigm of feminism prolongs an age-old divide of the household and the political sphere, the private and the public that goes back to ancient Greek society. Needless to say that the body, sexuality, women, children, and slaves fall on the side of the private. If we now for a moment try to leave this scheme of the individual body as stable but insignificant ground for the multifaceted colors of gender bearing behind, and indeed focus on that part that is seemingly only an asset to it, we encounter a far more complex scheme. Now we come to the third and also final part, no more private parts, from anatomical destiny to cultural genitals. There is a very nice cultural genital play being involved in this Austin Powers scene, because this character called Mini-Me that changed sides, he's actually a small replica of Dr. Evil, who is not in this scene, is very, very often in a kind of humorous but still a suspicious way, almost treated as a phallic, like a person that is at the same time a phallic function. And that's sort of the whole humor of this. In the perspective of denial, the genital is a body part serving a certain function, yet bearing not only anatomy, but the whole dynamic physiological relationship between individual and species in mind, and how a complex evolutionary process is in fact determining the morphology of the body. The genital is not a part of the body, but the soma, as the mortal body of the individual organism, is the function of the genital. This view, that was well known to Freud as son of Darwin's age, has been marked as biologist and essentialist by the classical paradigm of feminism. Thus, the whole sector of reproduction has been wiped from the discursive radar. Ever since the 70s, with its groundbreaking political fight for abortion and birth control, any discourse on lust, sexuality, and even gender has to refrain from any reference to the sphere of reproduction, as if the genitals, as literally reproductive organs, that's the Greek source, so it's about producing, genitals are the productive organs, or the creative organs, would be even more denied and private than the homonymic sexual organs. So to repeat this, because I understand that this is quite a competition there, but I created my own fate and my own destiny with this double feature, sort of overloading and overdetermining your attention, which is actually a pornographic gesture, as I realize in this very moment. So the thing is, so we have, I would really say, call it now a homonymy, it's not an identity, because that would be biologist in itself, but we have the genitals as the reproductive organs, or the productive organs, and genitals as the sexual organs, and there is a discourse stemming in a classical feminist paradigm that we have to, if we talk about the sexual organs, we have to forget about the reproductive organs, because they are a matter of biology, and we are not dealing with biology if we're dealing with sex. Anyway, I dare to go on. By calling the body a function of the genital, do I now propose a return to conservative assertions about the natural function of women and the true goal of intercourse? On the contrary, what I'm proposing here is to extend Haraway's new view of the body in the age of the cyborg to a highly contested field of reproduction. What usually stays unnoticed is the striking analogy that the strict separation of individual sexual lust from the sphere of reproduction follows the Marxist splitting of production and reproduction. So I hope Stefan is all ears here, because we are dealing with Marx now. The industrial pathos of production as a heroic endeavor of a male collective aiming at full control of the product has been a hidden agenda of misogyny, denouncing the sphere of reproduction for its biological messiness that does not produce a clear and clean cut in between producer and product, and by failing to do so always risks to produce a monster. Calling the body a function of the genital, in fact representing the virtually immortal species in relation to the mortal subject, which is actually perfect Freud, so that was exactly what made him introduce the death drive in the end, does not mean to re-evaluate the natural sphere of reproduction against the cultural sphere of production, but to call the very line in between production and reproduction into question. As I did before with sex and gender, the body and the genital. And needless to say that all these binaries and their criticism are densely intertwined in a metonymical knot. Biotechnology indicates that we are entering an age where reproduction is becoming a part of production. After we have recognized reproduction as a sphere as culturally determined and artificial as production, and having said that, we might also introduce a history of breeding as evidence that it has always been so, we could also dream up situations, fictions, narratives of production that bring reproduction back into play, setups in which the product stays precariously stuck with the producer, processes in which control is lost, maybe due to an overload of lust, messy and complex narratives breeding monsters that embody the vices of their careless parents, but in spite of their whole tragic suffering might still become their redemption. Of course, I'm thinking of Frankenstein's monster here, the inaugural narrative of biotechnology that is also a big parable on the mixing up of manufacturing and fathering, creation and procreation. I do insist on this new horizon, a new responsibility of procreation in an age of universal artificiality, as the simple step from the natural to the artificial genital, the tiny leap from organ to fetish, from biological mechanics to mechanical mechanics, comes too easily to become a big step for mankind. What this shift to the fetishist pluriverse indeed does not change, and also not even address, is the fixation on the genital as object and appearance, an approach that is nothing but self-evident and natural. Perceiving the genital primarily as a morphologically fixed object is exactly the view that Freud had introduced as the anxious gaze of the body about to enter the castration complex. In the very moment when the boy fears to lose his appendage, his genital becomes structurally artificial. Not the dildo or any fetish gadget, but the human boy's penis is marking the transition to the artificial, the cultural genital. There is artificiality at the very root of sexual difference, as it is marked by sexual desire as the primary cut relating and separating body and genital, thus marking the body as sexual. By failing to address this structure, the fetish culture of manufacturing artificial genitals seems to fall prey to a stereotypical mode of perception. Behavioral science has coined English translation, so it's a very nice term in German. It's called überoptimale Attrappe. Over-optimized dummy, maybe, might be something like it. In mating and hunting, animals respond to a simplified scheme of their object of desire. The fixation on the gestalt of the genitals is indeed evidence to this over-determination. The fact that many transsexuals want to perform an over-optimized gender role as soon as they succeed in changing their unwanted sex has been subject to some discussion. I consider it a very similar case that all the freedom that technology, media, and fantasy could provide for the creation of new genitals is often just used to produce simplified and over-optimized dummies of the regular ones. The artificial phallus is just a larger replica of the biological one. The artificial vagina sometimes resembles, in all her reduction to a tight slit, the little boy's view of the still uncanny and unknown female genitals as being a, in German we say it, Kloake, I don't know exactly the English word, I didn't look it up, an unstructured hole for both urine and defecation. I could now add some remarks on the genital as ornament, and I could insert a little anecdote that someone told me about a very touchy problem that a medieval church had with the fact that we are about to be resurrected in a full body. So this is actually the Orthodox claim that not our souls are living in the beyond, but the whole body. And then, of course, the question came up, and what about the genitals? Because in the afterlife, for sure, you will not produce any new offspring on the one hand, because timeless and so on, eternal, and on the other hand, it's anyway a place of lust. So to be in heaven is perfect lust, so there doesn't need to be any friction that adds lust to lust. And so there was, I think it was Saint Augustine who finally found an enormously elegant solution for the problem. So he said, yes, indeed, we will also be resurrected, including genitalia, but they will just be ornaments. So, I mean, if there is a kind of wonderland of pornography, it's Augustine's heaven, I would say. I could now add some remarks on the genital as ornament, but I just did, actually. And maybe even more importantly, on the local American phenomenon of size matters, which I call the cult of anamorphosis. Anamorphosis being the peculiarity of the phallic, not as erect and fixed, but as a dynamic function of swelling. In this sense, the phallic function does signify not anything tall, hard, and long, but the very lust for the morphing, the change of size, the swelling as such. One can return to Lacan's four fundamental concepts to refresh one's memory what anamorphosis was all about. Just one hint, it does not come without a skull. By criticizing the reduction of the cultural genital to the artificial fetish replica, I actually come to a rather ironic conclusion that the compulsion to stick to the biological form is evidence to the very artificiality of genitals in general. And how could it be otherwise, as the function of poiesis, of creation and procreation, has to be poetic in itself? Yet one could also be sinister enough to turn the argument around and state that the fetish lovers are the last ones to believe that anatomy is destiny or size matters, which is maybe the American version of Freud's quote of Napoleon's. So is there no hope for new and exciting cultural genitals? I do not want to quote Kafka there, who said that there is lots of hope, but just not for me. If I would be forced to sit through hours of hardcore, I unfortunately would feel doomed to stay in limbo. So repetitive and compulsory the claim that genitals are objects, are fetishes, etc. Too many tautological equations are in play to feed the eye of the beholder, let alone his or her imagination. One of the strangest problems of the interpretation of dreams that Freud had to solve was the question about explicit dreams about genitalia. So what does the dream of a literal penis stand for if the snake and many other objects signify the former? Freud could have taken refuge to more traditional schools of interpreting dreams, according to which a genital might signify not sex, but a lot of money, for example. And probably the over-explicit and over-optimized visibility of something like sex in the public sphere does simply actually not signify sex at all, but the very tendency of the phallic function to shift. The eyes that are fixed upon the object appearance of genitals, or at least their secondary stand-ins, because in public it's still rather the boobs, I would guess, but maybe that will change in the near future, are probably just making a futile effort to discover the secret of commodification as the social ground of production, but money stays abstract and invisible, and no gynecological body shot can give it a shape. One. This might be one of the reasons why I consider the commercial sex business and the culture of desire rather irreconcilable. This might sound old school, so be it. One of the reasons that brings me back to the beginning of this whole lecture is that desire does not emerge in a juxtaposition of objectified body parts and abstract currency, but is always already contaminating relationships and appearances. There is no desire without an object, but the object literally does not stand alone, as only a genital afraid of getting lost is forced to claim, but stays involved in a game of relations, a game of touching and morphing that is the game of desire. In this sense, I have for once to stick with Hitchcock's seemingly old European grumpiness when he stated he cannot make a porn film as long as they wouldn't invent a new genital. Therefore, science fiction film happens to be the better porn for me, and I'm not sure if I should play some clips with comments or if I have not run out of time already. I guess it's rather the last option. Yeah. But what we can do is you ask questions about the clips we just have seen and answer these questions as far as possible. Thank you.
There's I'm reminded of a sketch. I think it was in Saturday Night Live a couple of years ago. And there is this sketch about Freud and his daughter. Actually, I'm not sure if he had a daughter. Of course! My God. It's late. Oh, it's late. I'm of course, yes. Wow, Freud. And there's and the sketch basically, I mean, okay. And there's Freud's daughter. I'm pretty much sure it's not Anna Freud. It's just like the daughter, okay? And the daughter basically goes to Freud and says, Father, I dreamt of many men and they had bananas and I wanted their bananas. What does it mean, Papa? And Freud says, Daughter, sometimes a banana is just a banana. Okay, so I open like the questions now. So who won? Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about how you think that the internet is going to affect the sort of future development of the cultural genital? And in specific, you know, the number of sites out there that'll allow people to sort of, you know, develop their own persona or their own character. Can you talk about that a little?
A complete layperson. I mean, it's just like I'm kind of curious what will evolve. And I was just talking about my whole subject with a friend in New York, and he made a very interesting comment because he said now we are into the web 2.0 sort of innovation, which means that web content will be more or less provided and constructed, criticized, modified by a community. And what he said, and maybe he was wrong, I'm not really sure, is that pornography is one of those fields that is still waiting to enter this new interactive situation. My colleague Thomas Ballhausen today was actually describing the complete opposite of a new high-end, very expensive, very Hollywood-style porno industry. And maybe we are about to enter a situation where there are these two extremes happening side by side, like self-made, completely cheap, actually non-commercial porn, and on the other hand, these high-end products.
There actually is YouPorn. So YouPorn is something like YouTube, just like with amateur porn. And I think the first YouPorn kind of site went up in Germany. And most of the time, it's rather boring. They try to reenact the porn like settings, but they don't get like this like really like strange like intercourses and all the time they repeat geil, geil. It's interesting. So if you want to see really, really bad but like somehow interesting porn, you should go to YouPorn.
Or Pornotube.
Or Pornotube. That's basically the theme. That's the Web 2.0 application. Okay, one more question or two?
What I'm very interested in is, I used to be a big fan of Spock, like maybe other people of my generation. He was one of my first sex idols, in fact, when I was around 13. And what he's sexually speaking an extremely interesting specimen, because as we all know, he's very cool, very logical, very dispassionate. But all the Vulcanians undergo a seven-year cycle, and after 7 years they go mad. They are completely horny, very aggressive, and it's a so-called ponfar, and the creators of Star Trek had really the nerve to combine a super logical, wise civilization with an animal circle, and this is something I'm very interested in. And one thing that Spock does, I don't know if he also does it in ponfar, let's say he does it in his sort of cool periods, is this hands-on, this sort of mind melt act, and it's supposed to be therapeutic sometimes. Most of the time he tries to read the other's mind, but also sometimes he falls in love, but unfortunately YouTube doesn't have any of the erotic examples for some weird reason, so we only see a very late and kind of sad example of the elderly Spock performing a mind melt there in a film. And on the other hand, we also saw before another little clip from Barbarella where there's the same thing going on. There is this resistance army officer on another planet, and he learned to perform sex with a pill and only the hands touching each other, and they are so electrified that his hair stands up. One of the possible modes of cultural genitals is to sort of invest the hands in this sense.
Reminds me a little bit of what Annalie Newitz was talking today about, like the orgasm pill and the pieing of it, whatever. Okay. Yep.
Well, I'd have to advocate something that's modular and hot swappable for the future form of the cultural genital. How about something that is modular and hot swappable? Is hot swappable. You can change it out on the fly. Just like you can change, like, you know, you can plug a USB device into a computer, unplug it, everything like that.
Yeah, Cronenberg. Yeah.
So Cronenberg's existence is showing us this situation. Actually, it's a bit less messy and a bit less biological in Matrix, that you have this plug and you plug in and plug out. And here Cronenberg is very consciously playing with this ambivalence that you have this plug right on top of your hips or ass, crack, whatever. And so it's already close to some sort of erotic zone, and it's actually quite erotic situation between these two to play around with the pot.
So I guess I see Slim. Ah, Slim is here. So I think we can soon start with the next talk. And I would say a big applause for Katarina Zagrawski.